This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Wah! Wah! Good God, no!
What is it good for?
Absolutely nothing. Now listen to this. Wow!
All right, everybody. You are listening to the AWOL Radio Podcast on the Rabble Podcast Network. AWOL Radio airs weekly from 2 to 4 p.m. every Thursday on CKMS The Sound, 100.3 FM in Waterloo. You can find out all about AWOL at our website, peaceculture.org, where you can also find full archives of all our past shows. This week's show features audio recorded live from the Indigenous Sovereignty Week event hosted at the KW Community Center for Social Justice on October 27th. The event, titled Solidarity with Six Nations, Living on the Grand River Territory, featured several speakers. Here we present in two parts the two feature presentations of the evening. First to speak was Jim Windle, co-founder of Brantford's True, Two-Row Understanding Through Education, and the editor of the Tekanawagi newspaper, Canada's leading First Nations paper. The night's keynote was delivered by Melissa Elliott and John Henhock from Six Nations, the rising youth group Young Ongwehonwe United, or YOU. Both presentations speak about the ongoing struggles at Six Nations against ongoing colonialism, about the two-row wampum and settler responsibilities, and about Six Nations sovereignty, land claims, and the implications for settler communities in the Grand River Territory. Here now is part one of Solidarity with Six Nations, Living on the Grand River Territory, with True's Jim Windle of Brantford. Check it out.
What is it good for? Absolutely nothing.
Say it again.
My name is Jim Windle. I'm the editor of the Tekanawagi News at Six Nations. I'm a non-native who knew very little, in fact, nothing about the people of Six Nations when I took my first job at the paper there. And anyhow, when I did take that job, I realized not only how little I knew, but everything that I thought I knew was absolutely wrong. Because of what's being taught in schools, what is not being taught in schools, and living pretty well a football punt away from Six Nations, the largest in population, the largest reserve in Canada, and I knew nothing about the people until I started working there. And I took it upon myself to study, to listen to people, to ask questions, to try to get my head around the fact that I had to unlearn, as I said, everything that I thought that I knew. But probably one of the most fascinating things that I found out was something that has been treated in the schools and in the non-native culture as a quaint little Indian thing, which is called a wampum, or a two-row, in this case, the two-row wampum, which is right on your wall. These two stripes here are two. This is what the two-row wampum looks like. Just like this, white background, two purple stripes. Each one of these stripes represents a culture, language, traditions, and law. It was an agreement that was first made with the Dutch in the 1600s, first contact with the Iroquois people. And Ongwehonwe people is what they would certainly prefer to be called. But it's an agreement. It's always thought of in my culture as, like I say, a quaint little Indian artifact. But in fact, what it is a contract. It's a binding contract that was made between nations, between first the Dutch and the Iroquois, and then the French and the Iroquois, and then the English and the Iroquois, and even the fledgling United States and the Iroquois. I'm going to stop using that word, because actually the word means, what does it mean? It means flesh eater or snake eater. Yeah. It was a derogatory term that was given to people who called themselves the Ongwehonwe, the Haudenosaunee. So anyhow, let's get back to the two row, what it means. One row represents the non-native European settler community that came here. And in order to live without war, to live at peace between the two cultures, this agreement was made where my ancestors in our ship, full of my language, my culture, my history, and my laws, are represented by this line. The Haudenosaunee and their culture, laws, and language are represented by the other. Me and my ship, they and their canoe. The rest of it represents the river of life going on forever. And if you notice, if you run these, if this thing went on forever, one line would not intersect the other. And that was the idea. That was the agreement, that both would live in harmony together, but never interfere with the other's language, laws, culture, etc. And that was an agreement that was made. It was a peace accord. And I spoke to a political scientist once that told me that the Two-Row Wampum, the principles of the Two-Row Wampum, if adhered to by all people, there would never be a war. Not of consequence. Because it's a sign of mutual respect and mutual understanding. As I said, that was the most important thing that I learned. And the second most important thing that I learned was the fact that the Haudenosaunee people are not Canadians. Wrap that around your head for a minute. Not Canadians. We have been told all along, and whenever you read an article or a presentation by any politician, they'll talk about our Native people, our First Nations people, our... As if they belong to us. You know, we bought them. Okay, and they're our quaint little, blast of history that is a backdrop for what us great white folks have done. And that's not the case at all. So, again, if you can possibly get your mind around the fact that the Haudenosaunee people are not Canadians, everything else makes sense. But if you consider that the Haudenosaunee people are a part of Canada, now it gets confusing. Now it gets goofy. Because now you get the Gary McHales of the world saying, one rule for all, two-tier justice, and all of the catchphrases that he and his type put out there, which is just very thinly disguised racism. My wife and I began an organization in Brantford called TRUE, which stands for Two Row Understanding Through Education. Because it was such a revelation for me personally and for my wife to find out the principle of the two row, that it helped us to understand everything else. It's the hinge. That we thought, well, there's an awful lot of non-native people that need to understand this, that need to know. So we started an organization in Brantford called TRUE. And our purpose is to keep on reminding non-native people of those two points. A, not Canadians. B, there's an agreement, there's a contract that has been signed between my ancestors and Missy's ancestors that is binding. It's a contract. This isn't some quaint piece of native culture. Our culture is just as tied to that agreement as theirs is. The only difference is, since 1600, the Haudenosaunee people have kept the promise. As a matter of fact, I read in a book once that of all the treaties and all the agreements made with the Haudenosaunee people, not one has been adhered to, not one has been kept by the what we know as Canada. However, every one has been kept by the Haudenosaunee. So the fact that one side does not live up to an agreement does not make the agreement null and void. So the agreement's still in effect. So what we do at True is try to teach non-Native people that point, to try to drill into their head that the whole paradigm of who the people of Six Nations are has to shift, because people don't know. And as I said, if you don't know that they're not Canadians, then it really does get confusing. Then it does cause people to go, well, wait a minute, how come they get this? How come they get that? How come they get no water to drink? it creates a lot of confusion. And our motto at True is that ignorance is not racism, but racism has its root in ignorance. So that's why our job, our mandate at True, is to teach. And we don't teach from a white perspective, teaching about a Native culture. We provide opportunity for Native people, Haudenosaunee people, Hanwehome people, to put their own interpretation of history to the people of Brantford. We also use non-Native speakers as well, but who we use are our professional people. We use lawyers, historians, archaeologists, professors. That's our speakers. But they're not speaking about, we're going to tell you about the Haudenosaunee people. What they speak on is from our side of the Turo, our agreement, what we are responsible for. And so that's what we do with True. Now, I brought a couple of pieces of paper here. I'm just going to get these out of the way. I'll pass them around if you want. But these are two documents. Because people in my culture often say, well, you know, that happened 200 years ago. Why can't they just leave it alone? Well, it didn't happen 200 years ago. It started 500 years ago. And it's still going on today. The land theft, the treatment as if the Haudenosaunee people were some kind of children of the forest, Queen Victoria used to call them. And there's two documents here that just show graphically the attitude that Canada has always had, at least in recent years, to the people of the Haudenosaunee people. This one here I'll hand around was a declaration made. It was a circular that was handed out, an interdepartmental memo written by Duncan Campbell Scott in December of 1921. Just going to read a little bit of it here. It is observed with alarm that the holding of dances by Indians on the reserve is on the increase. My God, they're dancing! We can't have that. And that these practices tend to disorganize the efforts of the department in putting forth to make them self-supporting. So somehow Mr. Scott, Duncan Scott, who was the Deputy Superintendent General of Indian Affairs, he equated traditional dancing to something that had to stop. It was illegal. I have therefore to direct you to use your utmost endeavors to dissuade the Indians from excessive indulgences in the practices of dancing. You should suppress any dances which cause waste of time, interfere with the occupation of the Indians, unsettle them for serious work, injure their health, or encourage them in slothful and idle behavior. This is unbelievable. The racism in this man, if you read anything by Duncan Scott, the racism in this guy was off the chart. And it goes on to say here, you know, if in fact you do let them dance, or if you come across a dance, disperse it. But when you do that, I got to find it here, because when I read it, I was flabbergasted. Uh, Avoid overcrowded rooms, public assembly. Basically what they said is, basically what he said was, after the dance, make sure you fumigate the room. That's the kind of racist bullshit that has come out of our government since day one. And here's the other, here's another one that I find really interesting. People say, so how come Six Nations is bitching now? How come all of a sudden it's a big problem? Well, anybody that knows Canadian history, real Canadian history, will know that the bitching started like the day Joseph Brant and Six Nations got to what is known as the Mohawk Village in Brantford to take possession of the promised Haldimand deed. Because Joseph Brant soon found that the new superintendent that took over for Haldimand, John Graves Simcoe, arbitrarily lopped off 230,000 acres off the top of the Haldimand deed. Just lopped it off. And Joseph Brant, read in the book, actually what I read in was a book in the museum called the Simcoe Papers. So this is from the book that Governor Simcoe kept of his daily activities. And he speaks of his first meeting with Joseph Brant after taking the job as superintendent. And Joseph Brant expected to like this man, Simcoe, because his predecessor said that, oh, come on, Joe, you're going to love this guy. He's a great guy, right? So Joseph Brant went to John Graves Simcoe's house shortly after Simcoe got here, met with him, and immediately hated him because Simcoe was an obvious racist. Obvious. And Brant didn't like it. As a matter of fact, I think it was at that very meeting that Simcoe presented Brant with the draft of the what's known as the Simcoe patent, which was Simcoe's rewriting of the Haldimand draft or the Haldimand deed. Brant did not take it well. They got into a great big argument with Simcoe. Went home and reported to the rest of the sitting chiefs and clan mothers what was going on. And one historian that I read said that when Joseph Brant declared to the clan mothers, especially what was going on, that the clan mothers put the warriors on standby because they were ready to fight. They were ready to fight over the Haldimand tract. And we're talking about the first generation after Joseph Brant got here. I mean, we're talking just a few years after they got here. So, anyway, this document, I'm missing my point. This document is one of the reasons why some people say, well, or one of the answers why some people say, well, why are they bitching about it now? This document comes from from the Canadian Archives, and I'm not going to read it because I'm a terrible reader. But I'll tell you what it says, and I'll pass it around if you guys want. What it says is that any lawyer who takes a case of an Indian will be immediately disbarred. It was illegal between 1927 and 1952 for a native to hire a lawyer to protect himself in court. Our government did that. And that's another piece of history that we don't get taught in school. It was revoked in 1951, but it was so quietly revoked that it stayed as a common knowledge law up until 1959. So between 1951 and 1959, even though it was no longer a law, it was still in the minds of Six Nations people, well, you know, I can't, even if I wanted to go into the white man's court system, I can't. Because I can't hire a lawyer, or the lawyer will end up getting disbarred. So nobody was going to take their cases anyhow. Well, fortunately, that changed. And I'm just going to, you know, if anybody's interested, just pass it around. Just so you know, I'm not spinning anything. So, that's just some of the stuff, revelations that I've come across in doing my own study of Canadian history. And most of the documents the Six Nations have relative to land claims came from the Canadian archives. Because one thing the Brits really did well, they were really anal about paper. I mean, they wrote everything down. And now it's come back to bite them in the butt, because these papers are now still there. And the Six Nations research team, over 30 years, gathered all of these documents together that are currently being used in court, that are currently being used at the negotiating table. And these are government documents that the government can't say, well, that's not what you said, that's not what I, you know. The government tries to put the spin on it that Six Nations made up this stuff. In fact, there was a letter in the Spectator last week where somebody wrote in and said, well, you know, if those Indians would stop just talking about their oral history and their spoken traditions that have come down through the years, and just get away from that and start talking with, you know, about real documented evidence, the things would move along smoother. Well, obviously, this writer has no idea what he's talking about. At the negotiating table, there is one document. There was two. There's one document that the government has put on the table to prove, in their mind, that Six Nations have given up control of the entire Haldimand Tract. And it's known as the 1844 surrender. There was 3 years previous to that, in 1841, there was supposedly another surrender that, once again, Six Nations supposedly agreed to give away 930,000 acres in exchange for 48,000 acres, which is now the Six Nations Reserve. And that just doesn't make any logical sense to anybody. Why would they want to do that? So, anyway, the 1841 and the 1844 document were the two that were laid on the table at the negotiating table, but soon the 1841 was thrown in the can because of just simple logic. If the 1841 was a legal binding document, why did it have to be rewritten 3 years later in 1844? You know, like, it just, there's a whole lot of reasons I'm not going to get into now. There's a lot of reasons why both the 1841 and the 1844 document are totally bogus. First of all, the 1844 document that they're calling a surrender was actually the minutes of a meeting where the possibility of surrendering land was being discussed. It was not a legal binding document. But that's the only thing the government has, so that's the only thing that they're putting on the table. Meanwhile, Six Nations, on the very first day that they started getting into the meat of all of this, delivered 80 pounds of paper on the negotiating table and said, here's our evidence, and stepped back. And all of that evidence came from the Canadian archives. Canada walks in with one piece of paper and says, well, here it is, there. You gave it away. You know. So, anyway, that's how things are going at the negotiating table. Now, what do we talk about now? This coming rally that's coming up on the 7th, for Brantford at Victoria Park. It's a time for non-natives to stand up for our side of the wampum. For us to show our government that, hey, this is not a native versus white thing. This is a right versus wrong thing. This is our end of the two rope, which, as I said, my ancestors agreed to. This government has done things in my name that I'm, quite frankly, pretty pissed at. The more I understand, the more I study history, the angrier I get at my own government. Because they're doing this stuff to a sovereign people, to a sovereign nation, in my name. And this rally is intended to have non-Native people stand and say, hold it, do right by our agreement with the people of Six Nations. And part of that right is for Brantford to drop a goofy injunction that they placed upon land protectors from Six Nations in our city. Most of what is known as Brantford today is under land claim. And the original town plot was 600 acres. And basically it was set up to be a white man reserve. Because what was happening is that non-natives were coming in and squatting on Six Nations land. The government came to Six Nations at one point and said, look, if you guys just move on to this piece of property here, that'll allow us to go throughout the rest of your land and clear the squatters off of your land. So that's one of the reasons that the people of Six Nations, the chiefs of Six Nations at that time, agreed to move on to a reserve. Because there was conditions to that. Once again, promises made. There was conditions for that. And what was going to happen, what was actually written on the document for the Brantford surrender, was that as settlers got removed from Six Nations land, they had to go somewhere. So, you know, we'll offer you land in Brantford. Brantford started as a white man reserve. Okay? So, since then, land has been stolen. And that is what all of this is about in Brantford. That's why all of these work stoppages, because construction continues on land that still belongs to Six Nations, arguably. For more than 200 years, the people of Six Nations have been trying to get the government to account for not only the land, but an agreement was made with the Crown where the Crown was to look after their finances, was to look after their trust fund. When Joseph Brant and others began leasing land, which was intended to create an economy of perpetual care and maintenance of the people of Six Nations, Joe Brant had a good idea. Unfortunately, somewhere around 1835, some clown from England came over knowing nothing about the people of Six Nations, nothing about the Two Row, nothing about previous treaties, and said, you know, I really don't like this whole idea about 999-year leases, which is what Joe Brant used to work with, that and others, but the troublesome leased lands around Brantford were generally leased for 999 years. And so, this guy, what he did, he arbitrarily, with the stroke of the pen, turned all of those leases, which were supposed to create perpetual care and maintenance for the people of Six Nations forever, took that and stroked it out and made them all Crown patents. With the stroke of a pen, he stole thousands of acres with the stroke of a pen. So when non-natives now buy a piece of property and they get their lawyers to do a research, you know, like a search of the deed, it'll only go back as far as maybe 1835. When Bond Head, I forget his first name, Lord something or other Bond Head, removed all of Joseph Brant's leases and stole the land and sold it off, took the money in, and see, that's the other part of the kick. not only did they steal their land, but most of the money from the sale of that land did not make it into the Six Nations Trust Fund. It went to build things like McGill University, to build things like, of all things, Osgoode Hall in Toronto, which is the seat of Ontario Justice, of all things. That was built on stolen Six Nations land. Gosh, there's so many others. The Grand River Navigation Company. The chiefs at that time were supposed to have had the final say on what the government could or could not do with their trust fund money. And the government was supposed to be there to protect the natives and their finances and their money. And they went to the government ended up going to the chiefs one day and tried to sell them on this whole idea of funding a canal from the Grand River over to the lake, which would cut off a whole bunch of, it was just a good shipping idea of the time. But the chief said no. So they went ahead and took the money and used it anyhow. Well, 20 years later, Grand River Navigation Company went bust. And the 80% of the stocks in that company, when it went bust, actually belonged to Six Nations against their will. So all of the money that paid for that canal, and the Welland Canal, by the way, came out of Six Nations Trust Fund. So I know back in Brantford, and it's probably the same in Kitchener here, people go, what are they bitching about? Well, come on. Any amount of true history will reveal, as one book says, whenever the government and the Haudenosaunee people did a deal, Six Nations always got the worst of the bargain. There's a book called The Worst of the Bargain, which is really good. So that's some of the history there. Now here's the kicker. How does that affect Kitchener? Well, Brantford were shaking in their boots when the problem was in Caledonia. They were just glad it was over there, not on their doorstep. But there's actually more land claims in Brantford than there is in Caledonia. So when protests started happening in Brantford, delegation after delegation went to Brantford City Hall for more than 2 years, actually, and tried to talk to Brantford City Hall not to allow this to become another Caledonia. Speak to the people of Six Nations. Consult. Talk to them. Open dialogue. And delegation after delegation from every sector of Six Nations, the band council, the elected band council, they sent a letter to the city warning them to consult before they start disposing of contested Six Nations land. The Confederacy Council did the same. The Mohawk workers did the same. In fact, every sector of Six Nations said the same thing. And one of the main arguments that happened in Brantford, that I'm sure if things started happening in Kitchener, by the way, there's a huge part of Kitchener that is under claim. And it's just that it hasn't made its way up the river here yet, but it's coming. Your council here in Kitchener had better take a lesson from what Brantford didn't do. Because out of those 2 years of pleading with Brantford Council to consult and accommodate and at least open dialogue with the people of Six Nations, they refuse. To this day, they refuse. And instead of talking, they pushed through a couple of very goofy bylaws, which were illegal, because they were done behind closed doors. And if you know anything about civic law, you can't pass bylaws without it passing through three readings in public and get public input. They passed these two bylaws restricting Six Nations land protectors from being from stopping construction or protesting at any construction site, they named a number of them, in Brantford. So they shoved through these two bylaws and then went to the court and asked for an injunction based on the fact the Six Nations were not abiding by the bylaws. The bylaws were passed illegally, first of all. Why the judge gave an injunction, I have no idea, but he did. So that's the Brantford injunction. That's what it's about. And I have copies of this week's Tekka back there, but there was a very good thing happened yesterday. A man named John Garlow, who was the very first person arrested under this goofy injunction, finally got his day in court, 15 months after he was charged. And before they walked into the courtroom, the Crown dropped its case. Why? They had no evidence whatsoever on this man. So why did they charge him? People are being charged in Six Nations for defending their land under this injunction, which is illegal, to keep them away from future construction sites. And there's dozens of people who have been charged for standing on the line and for protesting or protecting what is theirs. And what happens is they're charged on the spot, not jailed, but asked to come in and to sign off an agreement where they agree to stay away from construction sites. So over the past while, the frontliners, those people who were willing to stand in front of the bulldozers and stand in front of the backhoes and stop them, have been picked off one by one. And they've been told, if you show up at another site, you will be arrested and you will be put in jail. So that's pretty well decimated the frontliners. But as John Garlow's thing came along, came up and fell down in court, everybody's hoping, of course, that it's just a sign of things to come. That as these other charges start coming to the courts, they too will be thrown out because there is no solid evidence to support these charges. So that's what's going on in Brantford, and that's what we are protesting as our side of the wampum, and anyone from Six Nations that wants to stand with us, fabulous, because that's a show that it's a graphic example of the two-row in action, where Native and non-Native are standing shoulder to shoulder against the real enemy, who is the federal government. So that's what it's all about. So I'm going to wrap it up now and pass it over to Missy. Did you want to do that?
I think, for the sake of